This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Pete Zimmerman produces the show. I'm John Williams. We frequently talk to Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network. Visit thelasallenetwork.com. Questions today are about two things with you, Tom. I want to talk about this event that you hosted with some of the HR people in Chicago, and also, does everybody need to have a degree to do the job? Welcome back. How are you?
Always good to be with you, John Williams. How are you?
Good. Talk to me about this conversation or this panel that you are hosting.
So we had leaders of three really iconic brands. Compass Real Estate, which is a national real estate company that just went public. I'm sure you've seen their signs.
Sure.
Culligan Water, which has been around for, I think, over 80 years. And then Radio Flyer, Chicago's own great toy company, and just corporate HR leaders talking about reentry into the workforce, into the office.
I love those guys over at Radio Flyer. We've talked to them a few times. That's just one of Chicago's great stories.
What are they saying?
What are they talking about reentry?
Well, a lot of them, it's interesting because Culligan, being a water filtration and supplier, is an essential company. So they've been back for the majority of their positions since last summer. So it hasn't really been a newfound thing for them. Radio Flyer is actually starting coming back with their internship program because they really believe in helping the youth in this country. They really want college kids to understand the brand. And in order to do that, they have to have some managers who run the intern program and those departments in the office. So they're starting there in June. And then post-Labor Day, they're going to do a hybrid Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in the office, Monday and Friday are voluntary. And then Compass has an interesting situation just because they've got their agents who are not employees, they're independent contractors, and then their back office employees, and they're on a region-by-region model of depending on what city and state people are working in. They have different rules for reentry.
Do you support that decentralized attitude about reentry, let it be as local a decision as possible?
Yeah, it's for the most part, every company's different. And I think that for a company that's grown as fast as a company like Compass has, I think having it on a local level is really important to keep that entrepreneurial spirit alive. I also think that every company should do what they feel. You know me, John, I'm a big believer in choice, meaning employees can choose to work someplace and they can choose not to. And companies should do what they think are right. And if employees don't like it, they should go find a different place. Choices are what makes America, America.
R.C. Bertrand on Chicago's Afternoon News the other day was talking about the need for a degree and maybe not the need for a degree for certain jobs. Have you had some thoughts about that as well?
Yeah, it really, again, I hate to beat a dead horse. It really depends on the company. I mean, we can go into to roles like software developers where degrees haven't been necessary since that role existed.
Yeah.
And then we can go into other positions where, you know, obviously accountants or doctors or lawyers, where it's secondary degrees, graduate degrees are important. For the stuff that's in between, whether it's sales or human resources or marketing, it really depends on several components. First and foremost, there's competence and intelligence. Number two, there's EQ, emotional intelligence, how people read the room. And then you have a resume that's based on it. If you've got somebody who didn't graduate from college and they have a new job every 18 months, that's a detriment on both sides. Versus if you've got somebody who's a little bit of a job hopper, but they've got a degree, it's only a detriment on one. So it's really buyer beware.
Well, I think there's a story in the Wall Street Journal about this, and I do like the idea that you could look at an applicant, and this is up to the corporate world to determine this. I mean, what does a four-year degree prove except that you can set out to do something and accomplish it? You're still going to probably have to train this person anyway.
Well, John, that's a pretty big thing you just said.
How so?
What does a four-year degree prove? That you set out to accomplish something and you did it.
Yeah.
Isn't that what work is? You set out to accomplish a goal and you achieve it?
If I had done 4 years in the military or worked 4 years in some other job and I didn't have a degree, I could say I have 4 years of that as well. But I don't have the
sheepskin.
Absolutely.
You are 100% correct. The problem is that a lot of people that haven't gone. Now, listen, I know I'll get the hate messages after this, so I want to be very careful what I say. But you have people that don't go to college, and they are the most stable, loyal employees, and I say kudos to them. But there's a lot of people that never learn how to fight through a bad teacher, fight through a bad major, fight through going to college and taking classes that aren't the most interesting, and they get to work, and it's the first time they've had to deal with that, and they cut and run. And those are some of the challenges of why companies require college degrees. And the other secret is, if you don't require a college degree or a graduate degree or a certain level of experience, you'd be going through resumes for forever.
Yeah,
you've got to have some way to differentiate.
Okay, that does thin the pack a little bit. That's more than a convenience. I know there's competencies that come with that. But I also do like the idea of a manager saying, I don't care if you got A's in your classes or if you graduated at all, I can tell you can do this task. How many of us know managers who do have a college degree and they're not great managers, but lucky them, they got a college degree in the job? I would rather find a way to find the most competent person rather than start with one who happens to have a degree.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. But now we're talking about skills that make you a good manager versus skills that get you a job. And you don't always know those things. Trust me. My grades at the University of Colorado weren't getting me on the dean's list, John. So I agree with you. My expression is, I don't want people who hit their peak at 18 so they could get into an Ivy League college. I want hustlers and doers who aren't afraid to roll up their sleeves and do whatever it takes. That doesn't say that everybody who didn't get a college degree has those skills either. So it's too easy to generalize. And in low unemployment, people who don't have college degrees are going to get more of a chance than they would in higher unemployment.
Right.
But we've got to also be looking at how do they present themselves, John? How do they package themselves? How do they interview? What's their emotional intelligence? Because a lot of folks have such a chip on their shoulder that it comes across as a negative, when you're exactly right. Not having a college degree can be positioned as a positive.
I'm glad you mentioned EQ. We'll have to talk about that another day. Tom Gimbel is the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Always interesting, Tom. Thanks for your time today.
Stay healthy, John. Talk to you soon.
If you want to see where the rest of the world is on this, some CEOs suggest dropping degree requirements in hiring in a recent issue of the Wall Street Journal. So listen to this statistic. It is estimated right now that the medical industry produces over 5 million tons of waste every single year. And that number is bigger right now because of COVID-19, the pandemic, and all of the other medical stuff that's been introduced into the environment. So there's a local medical supply company that is trying to create the industry's first 100% biodegradable medical gowns, for one thing. Joining us on the line is Dave Fliss. He's the CEO of PPE Plus. Dave, thanks for joining us on WGN. How are you?
Very good, Mr. Williams. Thanks for having me.
I'm a little startled by that number. I guess I hadn't thought about it before, but the medical industry produces a lot of stuff that, by design, they're not going to reuse, right?
That's correct. Back up through the late 70s, early 80s, a lot of things were reusable, but with the number of procedures and the infection rates and stuff, they kind of went to disposable product because it was more affordable, safer, and that type of thing. So, yes, it's a big part of the industry and the process.
Yours is a homegrown Chicago company. You guys make these biodegradable gowns here in Chicago?
Yes, sir. WellMed started in 2006, based in the Chicago area, and we supply products nationwide to the U.S. hospitals. And then when the pandemic started, we opened the factory in Little Village to support people in Chicago and to also help with the current need that we needed to get more isolation gowns to the medical hospitals and things. And, we started that. We started with the gowns that everybody else had. And then about halfway through, that's when we started looking for an innovative option that would be more eco-friendly. And we went with the biodegradable option as well.
But is a biodegradable gown
100% U.S. raw materials, 100% made in our Chicago factory, correct.
Does it keep the virus out?
Yes, sir. It's got the same ASTM testing standards, FDA approved, as a regular PE. It's just got an additive inherent in the product that makes it break down. When it's in the landfill for 6 months, between the heat and the pressure of the landfill, it breaks down to not micro pellets or microplastics like many quote-unquote biodegradable things do. This breaks down to 100% of its natural organic elements. So it's completely erased its footprint.
What is it made of? What is the gown made of? Is it cotton or paper or what is in it?
No, it is polyethylene plastic.
Really? But then, and then you introduce something, though, into the process that breaks it down at a micro level, huh?
Correct, right. It's about a 2.5 to 4% additive that goes into the process, or into the plastic as we blow the film. And that then allows it, there's no special storage or handling required for it in the warehouse or anything. But when it's under the heat and pressure of a landfill, that's when the additive kicks in and starts to break the product down and turn it back into its, we call it a biosimilation, because that's when it breaks down to its natural elements.
Got it. Well, it makes you wish or wonder why we didn't do this all along. I mean, that just sounds like a win-win, doesn't it? Are these gowns more expensive, though?
Well, the answer to that is from a manufacturing side, of course, because we're making them in the U.S., they're more expensive than product that we can buy from China. Right now, I want to keep this technology in the U.S. because I want to support this function. But it's something that we're looking at expanding right now from just the PE-based, the polyethylene, the plastic, to other materials that I can use elsewhere in the hospital system, which would be like for surgical gowns in a much
What about face
category.
Masks? I shudder when I see how many face masks are just blowing in the street or falling into the lake. Do you or can you make with the same material face masks?
They're a great question and very valid. And so if we can do the surgical gowns, then the answer is yes to the face mask, because the material in the face mask is similar or related to the product in the surgical gowns. The surgical gowns will be much tougher. So it should lead to a yes for this.
You said you could. Do you make the face mask then?
We make face masks domestically in the U.S., but we don't make it with the biodegradable yet because we don't have, there's three layers in the face mask and we don't have all those layers tested yet, but we're in the process of doing that. We should know that within the next 3 to 4 months.
I will order 7 million of them if you can get them out to us here pretty quick. 7 million. Put me down for 7 million, okay?
I'm writing that down. Oh, this is recorded, so good deal.
Yeah, right. I hope that doesn't mean I'm on the hook. But the other thing, you know, you're racing the clock here, aren't you? Because I presume the need for face masks is going to go down as we get to phase five.
Yes, and truthfully, the face mask, even the isolation gown, you know, critical need has flattened out. People have all their supplies. And to be honest with you, many of our customers even have months of inventory in their warehouse, so they're not necessarily buying at this moment. Mm-hmm. But the ongoing need is there. Hospitals and medical facilities and face masks will be worn in more larger percentage of areas than they were in the past, and the same with the gowns and things, too.
Well,
so
I think you're right about
that. The demand will be there.
Yeah.
The demand will be there.
Well, I think a lot of us are going to carry one with us where that would have, you know, I would have had an atomic bomb in my pocket more than I would have had a face mask once upon a time. And now, and while I'm a guy who's really anxious to burn the mask, I will carry one with me wherever I go just because somebody may ask me or because I may be a little anxious at times. So
I keep one in my wallet every time because I started going to places. I'm like, oh, I forgot it in the car.
Yeah, I know. I'll tell you what. I was halfway somewhere yesterday and thought, oh, where is my mask? I should keep one. And in fact, I had one in the car or in my back pocket or in my bag. But I've just got them littered around my life just to make sure I always have one nearby. Dave Fliss is the CEO of PPE Plus, PPEplus.tech is their website, a Chicago company with a biodegradable gown and masks to come. We'll visit then maybe. Dave, thanks for your time. Good luck and congratulations over there.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for your time.
Let's talk a little bit about another thing that's coming back in 2021, the ballet. The president and chief executive officer of the Joffrey Ballet here in Chicago is Greg Cameron. Greg, welcome to WGN Radio.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to share lunch with you.
Yeah, I'm glad you're doing that. So when does the season start now?
We last week announced jointly with the Lyric Opera that our season will open on October 13th of 2021. The Lyrics will open in September, but it was quite exciting to be in the beautiful Lyric partners, the Lyric, and jointly announce the return to the stage of opera and ballet. And we're most excited and thrilled that Chicago audiences are already telling us that they're excited based on subscription renewals.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second and how you can do that or maybe be a first-time subscriber. So do you know what the protocol will be since it's still half a year out?
Yeah, I was going to say the 800-pound gorilla, if you will. We, along with the Lyric, are following all of the city and state and CDC guidelines. And as things change, we are tweaking and making adjustments. I think based on, you know, current thinking, it looks like maybe by September and October, things will, quote, be the new normal, and there will be fewer restrictions. But through the entire pandemic, we have led, along with the Lyric, with a commitment to health and safety of all of the various stakeholders, if you will, from our artists to our audiences, and we will continue to move forward with that commitment. So there will be changes. The opening seasons will probably not find lobbies crowded with people having cocktails, but as we move into the season, we'll have a better understanding of what is safe and what is healthy.
And then the challenge, I presume, will be not just to put on the productions, but persuade people. And I guess if you're doing ballet, if you're doing opera, those are the kind of arts that I think are always trying to encourage people to patronize them. Give it a try. You'd be surprised how much you enjoy this. Your challenge is doubly so perhaps now, just given the lingering effects of COVID-19, right?
No, completely. I think that the opportunity with giving our subscribers the chance to be back in the theater. And as I said, we're seeing great progress there. But to your point exactly, engaging new audiences, which is something that we're doing all the time, but I think we're going to be doing with more vigor, if you will, and in partnership with the Lyric this year, and really in partnership with the entire city of Chicago. I have the good fortune of also being the chair of the State Street Commission, and I'm working with Mark Kelly and the deputy mayor of the city and others to bring people back to State Street. Mm-hmm. And I think as we bring people back to State Street, we move them into performing venues. It will be a combination of those that have tried us before, but maybe those that encountered some of our digital programming over the past couple of months that said, oh my gosh, I loved Bolero on video. Now I can see it on stage at the Lyric Opera. And we want to make sure that we are accessible to students and the whole gamut, of potential audience members.
What have the dancers been doing who have not been able to dance? Did they get unemployment? Did they get a supplement? How have they been getting along?
We, a year ago April, made a commitment to honoring our contract with our 45 artists. And actually, this Friday, they will be finishing their contract year, and we'll have a six-week break, and they'll return to Joffrey to begin rehearsal for the next season. So they have been on contract. They've been in the studios here at Joffrey Tower on State and Randolph since September, taking company class and training. And we have created three new pieces that were filmed and made available to audiences locally, nationally, and internationally through the magic of the internet. So it's been great. So they have been able to perform, but performing in front of a camera in our Pino studio here at Joffrey Tower. So they, needless to say, are very, very anxious to be on stage and have the opportunity to perform those same works live without masks. Last week at the Lyric, we had two of our company artists perform a a piece from Birthday Variations, which is a Jerry Arpino piece. It will be on the program. And I think the media in the house, everybody had goosebumps. You know, video is great, but live performances, I think, what we are hungry for, what they're hungry for, and our audiences are looking for.
Greg Cameron's the president and chief executive officer of the Joffrey Ballet, joffrey.org. So the season starts in the fall, and you have Mice and Men. You have George Balanchine's Serenade. I'm looking at Under the Trees, Voices, and Bolero, you mentioned. Don Quixote, Nutcracker at the end of the season. I don't know all of those titles so well. Can you just tell me about one that you're especially excited for?
Sure, Will. Excited about all of them. The opening season, as I mentioned, the October program called Home, A Celebration, is our inaugural season at the Lyric Opera. We were to start our season there a year ago, but COVID had different ideas. But as I mentioned, a piece by Jerry Arpino, who was, of course, one of the founders of the Joffrey Ballet with Robert Joffrey. So it's exciting to honor his legacy. And then three new pieces, two created by Joffrey team members, Nicholas Blanc and Yoshi Arai, who are both, Yoshi continues to dance at the Joffrey, but Ashley Weider, our Mary B. Galvin artistic director, gave them an opportunity, both Nick and Yoshi, to create new works. So those will premiere live, and then a new piece that is by Chanel Da Silva. Chanel was one of our winning works fellows, and Ashley was so moved by her work that he commissioned her to create a new piece that actually premieres this Friday, May 28th, on Joffrey.com in film, and then will premiere on the stage in October. So it's exciting to bring three new artists' work to the stage, followed by Don Quixote, which is a classic, and then, of course, of Mice and Men by Kathy Marsden, and the Nutcracker. You know, Chicago's beloved Nutcracker will be on stage at the Lyric in December, and just up the river, we'll be continuing our partnership with Art on the Mart and have the Nutcracker on the facade of the merchandise art as well.
All right, Joffrey. You said com. Is it org? Where should you send us today, Joffrey?
I'm sorry. It is joffrey.org.
Fair enough.
Apologies. I get in trouble from our marketing team.
Oh, you should see my producers look at me when I get it wrong, and I usually do. So let's make sure we do it right. Joffrey.org, joffrey.org. Go to joffrey.org today. Greg Cameron, nice to talk to you.
Many thanks.
Yeah, congratulations to you all, too. It's 12:45. How about that? The dancers have been paid. They honored the contracts. They've been practicing, and they're ready in the fall. It's 12:45 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Okay, WGN Radio Business News continues now with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Regulatory filings show Alden Global Capital has closed on its $633 million purchase of Tribune Publishing. The completion of the deal takes the Chicago-based newspaper chain private. As a result, Tribune Publishing, with ticker symbol TPCO, has been delisted on the NASDAQ. The SEC filing says Tribune Publishing CEO Terry Jimenez received $1.7 million in equity compensation, while three other non-Alden board members and the company's interim chief financial officer also received payouts as a result of the merger. By the way, a memo to union reps today says Jimenez is no longer with the company. Rosemont-based Culligan International is being swallowed up by private equity firm BDT Capital Partners. The Wall Street Journal reports terms of the deal haven't been disclosed, but a person familiar with the matter says the deal values Culligan at $6 billion. Advent International is Culligan's current majority owner and plans to reinvest in the business and hold a minority stake. Culligan sells products and services for water filtration and treatment and was founded in 1936 as a maker of water softeners. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, we need water to grow food, Johnny, and there are some areas around Chicago that have had plenty of rain. Others are still behind, and there are other areas of farming America where it is so dry. And if this were the Tonight Show in the 1980s, everybody in the audience would yell out, "How dry is it?" Except it's no laughing matter.
These are some of the driest conditions on record in some parts of the state.
That's Megan Overby, who ranches with her husband in central North Dakota near the town of Binford.
We run about 300 cow-calf pairs on our ranch, as well as farm about 2,000 acres of cropland.
Megan's also a farm broadcaster with the Red River Network, and her tweet a couple of days ago drove home just how dry it's been. She posted a photo of a syringe with the caption, "Fingers crossed we don't have to treat too much more dust pneumonia after this weekend." Dust pneumonia?
Some of those common pneumonia-like symptoms include watery eyes, nasal discharge, and labored breathing.
I should point out she's talking about calves, not humans.
We've even had some cases where those dust particles have irritated their eyes so badly that essentially that eye goes bad and it is blind in the calf.
Large parts of North and South Dakota went without meaningful moisture since last August. There were dust storms, including one that lasted days.
Starting on March 30th and lasted for about 2 or 3 days.
Pastures weren't greening up, crops weren't coming up, or just going unplanted, but a few days ago,
some people got as many as 3 inches of rain in 1 hour.
So, a happy-ish ending from rancher Megan Overby in North Dakota, who's hoping it isn't another 9 months before it rains again. And there is a generally crop-friendly Midwest weather outlook for the next couple of weeks, with forecasters giving a favorably mixed rating for nearly all grain and oilseed areas to get rain at one time or another, and that's put downward pressure on prices at the Chicago Board of Trade. Yeah, now at the Chicago Board of Trade, soybeans are down 18 cents, corn is down 37 and a quarter cents at 620 per bushel, and that is probably because of the favorable weather and also because of some profit-taking going on before the the long weekend. And from the farm to your belly today, it's National Wine Day. No farmers, no wine. The U.S. is number 6 among wine-exporting countries. France is number 1. Italy is number 2. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
Sandy Price is the executive director of the Rogers Park Business Alliance. When you travel throughout some of the neighborhoods in Chicago, suburbs too, sometimes you'll find streets or blocks blocked off to accommodate more outdoor dining and shopping. That vestige of the pandemic may be something we could keep throughout the year, or at least past the pandemic. Sandy, thanks for joining us here on WGN.
Thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it.
So this Chicago Alfresco program includes Rogers Park. What are you all doing in Rogers Park?
So we currently have one area, we currently have one area of Rogers Park, Jarvis Square, that was, that applied for the extended outdoor dining program during last summer. And so we're going to expand on that program by doing more permanent closures. And then we actually have a second location on Glenwood Avenue that we will also be closing. And, you know, our hope is that we will get people out of their houses again, right? That's the hope for all of this. So we're looking to do community spaces, entertainment, dining, events. We also have a farmer's market that is normally for 10 years was on Glenwood. And due to COVID last summer, we had to move it to an enclosed parking lot.
Do you know about the economic impact? Does this help or hurt, since it also keeps people from being able to drive through parts of the town and presumably spend money? Is there an upside economically on this?
Yeah, we specifically chose two areas that are not heavily vehicle, traffic. Mm-hmm. So they're both much more pedestrian friendly. The Glenwood area is a cobblestone street, and it's one way along the red line tracks for the L. So a ton of pedestrians are right there. The Jarvis Square space is where the Jarvis Red Line station is. So again, very pedestrian friendly. And we did that intentionally.
Yeah. And how's it been going? Have the people been showing up, and are they showing up in greater numbers than previously?
So we haven't done any of the street closures yet. So the extended outdoor dining is there, but this new alfresco program has not been put into effect yet. We were notified that we were awarded the grants for the two areas, and we still need to do some homework. We need to meet with the city, see what they will allow us to do. On Jarvis, where they did the extended dining, it allowed all of these businesses that had to shutter and were not allowing people inside to bring their business out onto the streets to the people. And yes, their business flourished when we were able to do that.
We will conclude this conversation now and maybe check in down the road and see how it's going. But is there a date at which I can look for the full version of this then?
Not that I'm aware. There will be a date, but I don't know yet what that is.
Well, I share your optimism, though. It just seems to me like this, it brings the community out. It creates a sense of community where there already is a community. It'll actually seem to be a little more interactive. You'll see the human beings, and people like being outside. That's where I am. The vestige of the pandemic may not be a bad thing. So, Sandy, good luck to you all, and thanks for joining us. She's the executive director of the Rogers Park Business Alliance. Stay tuned.